This is the BC Youth Conference 2017. Our general theme is Moses, and this is our first class entitled Looking Back to Genesis. We'll call forward our brother Jason Hensley, please.
Thank you, Brother Josh. Good evening, everyone.
Good evening.
How are you?
Good.
How about that dessert tonight? Wasn't that wonderful? Oh, man. And there were two flavors, too. That was pretty good. All right, so we are talking about Moses, but first I thought you might want to know a few things about me. This is kind of silly because you've already met my kids, but sometimes people like to know these things. These are my children. That's Bethany. That's Sarah. Bethany graduated from preschool this year, so that's what that picture is. And that's Grace. She's learning to use a straw. There you go. The other thing that people find interesting is this is where I work. I'm the principal of the Heritage School in California. Yay! This is 2 years ago. Did you guys notice that? You're in the picture right there. Isn't that fun? Okay. So, there we go. Those are just some things that people like to know. Now, on to what really matters. This is what we are going to be doing for, God willing, the next 5 days. You work through your Moses workbook, and I thought that it might be kind of nice to fill in a little bit of the details, right? You've been thinking about Moses. So my goal is to kind of remind you about Moses, the things that you went through, you know, 100 pages ago, and just to also give you a little more details to kind of chew on. So this is our plan. We're going to look at Genesis tonight. We're going to be spending our time in Genesis 15. Tomorrow night, we're going to look at terror in Egypt, and we will specifically be looking at Exodus chapter 1. So this is the story of the midwives and all of that. It'll fit well with our discussion groups. Then, on Tuesday, we will talk about the birth of a deliverer. So that's Moses' birth, Exodus 2, 1-9. On Wednesday, a man mighty in word and deed. This is when Moses slays the Egyptian and flees from Egypt. And then our last session together will be Moses in Midian. So we're going to be doing a lot of detail here, looking specifically at Exodus 1 and 2. And I just think that's helpful because the workbook gave us a really solid foundation on going deeper, and so now here, we're going to try and go deeper. So that's the plan. That's our goal. Now, I tried to say it a little more eloquently here. So to realize that these stories are about real people with real struggles, yet these struggles molded and shaped the most humble man save the Lord Jesus Christ. So you remember yesterday in our intro, we talked about humility and its importance. Numbers 12, verse 3 reminds us that Moses was the most humble man aside from the Lord Jesus Christ, and Matthew 18, 3-4 explains that if you do not get the humility of a little child, don't expect to see the kingdom of God. So humility, as we said, is one of our first principles of action. So that's the plan. We want to learn what is true humility. So we have a core message in each class all about what true humility means. So here's what you can look forward to. In class one tonight, you can't read that at all, so don't worry. I will read it to you. So tonight, we are talking about looking back to Genesis, and we will be looking at the way in which true humility admits, this is step one, that God's ways are higher than man's ways. So we want to just recognize that right off the bat. True humility, first step is recognize that God's ways are higher than man's ways. Tomorrow, when going through terror in Egypt, we are going to note that true humility waits for God's vengeance, right? This, again, is in the beginning, because before you get this humility, when people start doing things to you, you feel the anger flare up, and you feel this desire for vengeance, and you have to recognize that we are to wait for God's vengeance. So we'll look at that tomorrow. Then, when we're talking about Moses' birth, we are going to show that true humility recognizes that all things revolve around the Lord, as opposed to us, right? Everything revolves around the Lord, not us. So that's lesson number three. Lesson number four for class number four is when we're talking about when Moses killed the Egyptian. True humility, this is when we start moving past the intro to humility. True humility is grateful for chastening. Whoa, that could be the hardest one. So true humility is grateful for chastening. And our last lesson, and this is really kind of an aspect of humility that we don't often think about, and that is true humility acknowledges that God can work in us mightily. So not only that God's ways are higher than ours, not only is everything about the Lord Jesus and his Father, not us, not only are we going to be chastened, but God can actually do big things through us. And that's an aspect of humility we don't often consider. So that's the plan. You feel good about that? I hope you're excited about that. Looking forward to seeing how this all kind of plays out. So here is what we're doing tonight. Looking back to Genesis, there we are in class one. We have three sections. First is the foundations in Genesis, right? We'll notice, and you may remember from the workbook, that the story of Exodus is intimately connected to the story of Genesis. So we're just going to note that connection because that's helpful. We're going to spend some time on the 400-year curse, and we're going to make a timeline looking at when the children of Israel were in Egypt. And finally, we're going to talk about assimilation. And we're going to go beyond just Egypt, but we'll talk about Egypt, Persia, and then eventually into the modern times and how assimilation has plagued the Jews. And as we do that, we are going to attempt to answer this question. Why did God send Jacob's family into Egypt? Now you could say, well, because Joseph was there. Okay, but why did God send Joseph there? Why Egypt? You know, why didn't he send them off into, like, the Far East? Why not to China? Right? I mean, you know, he could have sent them anywhere. So why did he send them specifically into Egypt? So we want to look at that. We always want to be asking why. You remember that from yesterday? Always ask why. So this is the why that we're going to try and answer. And really, our overarching idea is that true humility admits God's ways are higher than ours. Here we go. So our foundation in Genesis. Now, let's just go ahead and read Exodus chapter 1. Let's remind ourselves of what that's about. Exodus 1, verses 1 to 5. So Exodus chapter 1, as we read this, I want you to think about what would you do with these verses if there was no such thing as the book of Genesis? Okay? So just try and, I know that's going to be hard because we love Genesis. We've memorized parts of a lot of Genesis, right? Well, you have to attempt, this sounds really bad, you have to attempt to try and forget that, okay? But only forget it for like 30 seconds. All right, here we go. What would you do? What would this sound like if you didn't have Genesis? Exodus 1 and verse 1 says, "Now these are the names of the children of Israel which came into Egypt. Every man and his household came with Jacob. Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, and Benjamin, Dan, and Naphtali, Gad, and Asher, and all the souls that came out of the loins of Jacob were 70 souls, for Joseph was in Egypt already." I'm going to close this. So what would you do if you didn't have Genesis? Was that person supposed to be driving by? Do we know who that is? Should I chase him down? Okay, anyway. So what would you think about this if you didn't have Genesis? What would you do with Exodus? I think the point is, it wouldn't make any sense at all, right? Without Genesis, you'd read this and you'd be like, oh, great. Reuben and Zebulun and Naphtali. Who are they? why are we reading about these people? So it wouldn't make any sense. The point is that Exodus is a continuation of Genesis, right? They're two different books, but we want to note this one comes right after the other for a reason. They are intimately connected. And so when you read the end of Genesis, notice how nicely this ties in. Look at what Joseph emphasizes here. Ready? Joseph emphasizes something. See if you notice it. This is the last chapter of Genesis, Genesis 50, verses 24 to 26. "Joseph said unto his brethren, I die, and God will surely visit you, and bring you out of this land unto the land which he sware to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. Joseph took an oath of the children of Israel, saying, God will surely visit you, and ye shall carry up my bones from hence. So Joseph died, being 110 years old, and they embalmed him, and he was put in a coffin in Egypt." Do you notice anything emphasized? Yeah, Caleb? Death? Yeah, he brings that up a couple of times, doesn't he? That he's going to die, you're going to carry my bones. Joseph dies. And the point of his death is that... Whoa, that wasn't it. The point of his death is... I meant to underline the other one too. Right there and right there. He says it twice. God will surely visit you. God will surely visit you. Right? And he is so convinced that God is going to bring them up that he says, carry my bones. Right? Don't leave my bones here. So just keep this in mind. God will surely visit you. Here's our indication that Exodus is a continuation. At the burning bush, consider what God says. Exodus 3, verse 16, he says to Moses, go and gather the elders of Israel together and say unto them, ready? The Lord God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, of Isaac, and of Jacob, appeared unto me, saying, I have surely visited you. Have you seen that before? Right? Joseph said, be ready. The day is going to come when God visits you. And God comes in Exodus chapter 3 and he says, here it is. I'm visiting you now. I'm going to bring the people up and out of the land. So we want to just notice this link. Genesis and Exodus are intimately connected, and even more so than just these like cursory ideas. But the whole idea of Exodus, the whole purpose of Exodus really is contained in the prophecy that we read in Genesis 15. So we want to spend some time in Genesis chapter 15. So you worked on the workbook, you kind of read through this. So I got a question for you. There's a promise in Genesis 15 that Abram's seed would go to a land that is not theirs and they would be afflicted. How long would they be afflicted? What was that? 400 years. Afflicted for 400 years. And in fact, we know certainly that this comes to pass in the Exodus because you'll actually notice that we're told that they will serve and be afflicted for 400 years. And those same words show up in Exodus 1, verses 11 to 13. Right? The same words are used, Exodus 1, 11 to 13, that they served in hard bondage and they were afflicted. So we can see, okay, connection here, right? Let's take this 400 years, though, and figure this out. Have you ever thought about this? I know that for a long time I grew up in Sunday school, and you may have noticed it in the chart in your workbook, but that's only if you did that part. Because that was kind of like, looked semi-optional. I don't know if any of you guys considered it to be optional. When I did it in 2007, I was looking at my old answers. I didn't do that one, so I guess I thought it was optional. So that was when it was the Manitoulin workbook. I was like, hey, I left that blank. But anyway, so if you take a look at this, I always thought growing up, right, that the promise says they'd be afflicted for 400 years, and so therefore, automatically, Israel is enslaved for 400 years, right? That's how it sounds to me in my mind. Now, come over to Galatians chapter 3. Galatians chapter 3, and let's notice why this doesn't work. Galatians chapter 3, think about this as we read through it. What beginning point does the Apostle Paul give to this time period, and what end point does he give to it? Beginning point and end point. Galatians chapter 3. Take a look at verse 16. Galatians 3, starting at verse 16. What's the beginning and ending point? Here we go. Now, to Abraham and his seed were the promises made. He saith not, and to seeds as of many, but as of one, and to thy seed, which is Christ. This I say, that the covenant that was confirmed before of God in Christ, the law, which was 430 years after, cannot disannul, that it should make the promise of none effect. You might need to read that a couple of times. What's the beginning point and what's the end point of his time period? Ooh. He's talking about the covenant and the law, he says. So the way that the King James kind of organizes that verse makes it a little tough to understand. Those of you guys that have a newer translation might find yourself slightly ahead on that verse. What he's saying is that from the time period of Abraham, right, when the covenant was given to Abraham, to the time when the law was given, right, the time of the Exodus, was 430 years. Now that's interesting because we're told that the promise in Genesis 15 says that they would be afflicted and enslaved, at least that's how it sounds, for 400 years. So do you see why we're starting to run into a little bit of an issue here? Because the Apostle Paul says that essentially he had 30 years on, right? And somehow, if this is talking about the enslavement, that means that Abraham to Isaac to Jacob going to Egypt lasts 30 years. That doesn't really work. That's a little difficult, right? So somehow, we have to figure out then, okay, Abraham to the Exodus is 430 years. We have to figure out then what is actually going on with these 400 years in Genesis 15. So let's put this together. What's happening here? What are these 400 years? There's some starting point 30 years after Abraham is given the covenant. So still within whose life? Still within Abraham's life that these 400 years of affliction begin. Have you ever thought about that? That's a little crazy. So, here's a suggestion. Think about this. There might be a hint in Genesis. Notice that the language says they would be afflicted for 400 years. It doesn't say enslaved. It does say that they would serve, but afflicted. Here's what Stephen says about it. You'll notice that he uses similar language here. This is Acts chapter 7. This is Stephen's commentary. Stephen says in Acts 7, verses 6 and 7, God spake on this wise, that his seed, that's Abraham's seed, should sojourn in a strange land. Sojourn in a strange land. That's interesting. And that they should bring them into bondage and entreat them evil 400 years. So notice what he says. He explains it by saying they would be treated evil for 400 years. Same kind of idea, afflicted for 400 years. So what we're looking for then is somehow there must be a place in the life of Abraham where the Egyptians treated the children of the promise, the faithful children, Abraham's seed, evil. And that would span for 400 years. So let's consider this. Ready? What do you know about Egyptians and Abraham? Yeah. Hagar. Oh, interesting. So that's a very intriguing one. Here's why. Abraham and Sarai were promised a seed, right? Didn't work. Didn't come when they hoped. Well, it did work. Sorry. It did work. But just not when they wanted it to, right? Didn't happen when they wanted it to. So, you get Hagar showing up in the picture. Now, I want you to notice something. Consider how Hagar is described. I don't know if you've noticed this before. You might actually find this helpful to underline in your own Bible. Look at this. Genesis 16, verses 1 to 3. Now Sarai, Abram's wife, bare him no children. She had a handmaid, an Egyptian, whose name was Hagar. Sarai said unto Abram, Behold now, the Lord hath restrained me from bearing. I pray thee, go in unto my maid. It may be that I may obtain children by her. And Abram hearkened to the voice of Sarai. And Sarai, Abram's wife, took Hagar, her maid, the Egyptian, after Abram had dwelt 10 years in the land of Canaan, and gave her to her husband Abram to be his wife. Do you notice something about Hagar? She's called Hagar the Egyptian. This is who she is twice, right? It emphasizes here she has a handmaid, an Egyptian. He took Hagar, her maid, the Egyptian. But it doesn't just end there. Consider this. Turn to Genesis chapter 21. See if you notice anything. Genesis 21. Let's look for a pattern. Here's when dear Miss Hagar shows up again. Genesis 21 and verse 9. Now, we clearly know who Hagar is, right? We've been told that twice in Genesis 16. She is Hagar the Egyptian. Well, guess what? Genesis 21 verse 9 says, And Sarah saw the son of Hagar the Egyptian, which she had borne unto Abraham, mocking. Once again, she is Hagar the Egyptian. And turn over to where she shows up again. Genesis chapter 25. Genesis 25 and verse 9. 12. Sorry. Genesis 20, 25, verse 12, says, "Now these are the generations of Ishmael, Abraham's son, whom Hagar the Egyptian, Sarah's handmaid, bare unto Abraham." And thus, Hagar the Egyptian, bears a son, and guess who he becomes? He is Ishmael the Egyptian. And this is who he really is, because in Genesis chapter 21, Hagar chooses a wife for her son, and guess who she chooses? Surprise, an Egyptian. So what you get going on here, I don't know why there's a question mark there, by the way. So that it looks like the Anne has a little hairdo going on. That's not supposed to be there. But what you got going on here is the point is that throughout this record of Genesis, the record takes pains to show us that Abraham clearly had a conflict with an Egyptian within his own family. Interesting. So when Isaac was born, what you end up having then is the Egyptian seed and the Hebrew seed are living in the same house. Child of the flesh, child of the promise. And so, therefore, it's not long before persecution begins. There's our timeline. Let's take a look. You remember the story? Genesis 21. Let's go to Genesis 21 and verse 8. Genesis 21 verse 8 describes the persecution of the child of the promise by the Egyptian. So Genesis 21 verse 8, take a look. It says, "And the child grew and was weaned, and Abraham made a great feast the same day that Isaac was weaned. Sarah saw the son of Hagar the Egyptian, which she had borne unto Abraham, mocking." So there you go. Persecution begins. Ishmael mocks Isaac sometime. Aha! That's where the question mark's supposed to be. Anyway, there you go. It should be right there. It jumps slides on me. I guess it didn't like being there. Well, anyway, that's where it is. Maybe Ishmael mocking Isaac could be where the 400 years begins. I'm going to suggest to you that it does, and I actually think we can prove it. So throughout this time of 400 years, it is indeed true that Egypt afflicts the children of the promise. Joseph is in prison. The slavery happens, clearly. So the relationship is not so awesome throughout these 400 years, beginning with Ishmael. Oh, well, look at that. I don't know why that other one was there then. Whatever. So can we actually be sure that this was 400 years? Yes, I think we can. Let's take a look. It's time to create a timeline. Ready? Here we go. Here's what Galatians says. We want to establish a good starting point. Remember what we said earlier? Galatians chapter 3 begins the 430 years with what? Not just Abraham, but something specific in his life. What was that? Yeah, the covenant. So it begins with the covenant, but that's a little tricky. So we have it very clearly here, right? I say that the covenant that was confirmed before of God in Christ, the law, which was 430 years after, cannot disannul. So the covenant came first, 430 years later came the law. All right? Well, why does that make the timing a little difficult as far as a starting point? Well, because Abraham got the covenant like, you know, 5-6 times, right? So the question then is, are we talking about Genesis chapter 12, when he was given the covenant? Are we talking about Genesis 13? Are we talking about Genesis 15? Are we talking about Genesis 17? Or are we talking about Genesis 22? I don't know. No, just kidding. Okay, here's what I think it is. Here's my thought. Notice that which time? Here's some of the ones that we have up here. I only put those three because, well, it's one of those. Exodus chapter 12 sheds a little bit of light on this. Come and turn over to Exodus 12 with me. Exodus chapter 12. Take a look at verse 40. We want to note a word here that is very much connected to the covenant with Abraham. Think about what Abraham was commanded to do when he was given the covenant, okay? And now look for this word, because Exodus chapter 12 is going to talk to us about, once again, a 400-year time period that ends with the Exodus. So we know we're talking about the same period here. Okay? Take a look. Verse 40 says, "Now, the sojourning of the children of Israel who dwelt in Egypt was 430 years. Do you hear a word there connected to the promises to Abraham? The sojourning. When was Abraham commanded to be a sojourner? We're talking Genesis chapter 12. Right? This is when God says, "Get thee up from thy country, from thy kindred, from thy father's house, unto a land which I will show thee." So the sojourning of the children of Israel is 430 years, and it begins in Genesis 12. So we have a starting point. Isn't that exciting? So there you go. You don't have to be floundering off wondering where it is. I know you'll all sleep well tonight. So Genesis 12, 1-3, this is really where this 430 years begins. So let's continue then. In Genesis 12 and verse 4, we have our actual word of this idea of sojourning. And we're told that when this takes place, Abram was 75 years old when he's given the promise. So now we get to work with some years. Now, if you're wondering and you're thinking, wow, this is kind of technical, have no fear, because this is the only class that's like this. So hold on to your chair and your brain, and we're going to make it through this, and then the other ones aren't this way. But I think we can get through this guy and see how this comes together so nicely. So Abram at 75 is when the sojourning begins. We know that 430 years later is the Exodus. Does that make sense so far? Based off of Galatians chapter 3 and Exodus chapter 12? Good. So then, Genesis 21 verse 5 tells us how old he was when Isaac was born. Anyone remember? 100. So he's 100 when Isaac is born. Okay, so let's move a little bit on our timeline here. There. So, if Abraham is 100 at Isaac's birth, that means that there are only 405 years until the Exodus. Yeah? Thumbs up? Make sense? Okay, 405 years until the Exodus. Good. All right. Now then, Genesis 21, verses 6 to 8, this is where we get the weaning of Isaac. Now, we don't actually know when that took place. However, there are a few things that we know. Persecution begins when Isaac is weaned, we know that. And we don't know how old Abraham was, but we can maybe make a guess. If you go to 1 Samuel chapter 1, we won't go there now, what you will realize is this is the story of Samuel. And Hannah gives Samuel to the tabernacle when he is weaned, right? How old was he? We don't know. But we do know that he's a lot older than just a little baby that you can, like, bring and give to the priest of the tabernacle and be like, okay, you nurse him and he'll be fine, right? Like, that's obviously not going to work. So he must have been a few years old. And it seems like throughout the Old Testament, this is what we're talking about. The same thing happens with Moses, and we'll see that later, that he's old enough to begin to digest the truth, right, and kind of get it into his head before he is weaned. Because when Moses is weaned, that's when he's given back to Pharaoh's daughter. So back in the day, you nursed kids for, like, years in that time. So it's very interesting, then, that when Isaac is weaned, that it very well could be that he was 5 years old. And that's when Abraham is 105 and when the persecution begins. Which would mean that from Isaac being weaned to the persecution just so happens to be 400 years. Well, I think I've heard that time period before. And so what I think we can say almost definitively, right, we don't know how old he was. Maybe he was like 3, but I think he was 5. Because that gives us our 400 years perfectly. Now then, here's where this gets very interesting. So if we then say from Isaac's persecution to the Exodus is 400 years, right? This is when the promise in Genesis 15 begins, of them being afflicted for the 400 years. It begins with Ishmael, the Egyptian, mocking Isaac. Well, then it's really interesting because we can work through the ages of the patriarchs and actually realize that the children of Israel were in slavery for a lot shorter of a time period than we may have initially thought. So think about this. Genesis 25, 24 to 26, tells us that Jacob and Esau's birth takes place when Isaac is 60. So we had Isaac born here, so this is now 55 years later, right? When Isaac's 60. 55 years later, Jacob and Esau are born. So that's 400 minus 55. So from Jacob's birth to the Exodus is 345 years. But we can go a little further, because Jacob then goes into Egypt, right? And he actually tells us how old he is when he goes to Egypt. So when he moves to Egypt in Genesis 47, he's 130. So 345 minus 130 gives us 215 years. Now, here's the final one. In Exodus 7, verse 7, we find that Israel's deliverance begins when Moses is 80 years old, right? You remember that? 40 years when he becomes their, when he wants to be their deliverer, and then 40 years in Midian. And so therefore, Pharaoh's attack on Israel's children and the slavery begins 80 years prior. So that's like Moses born approximately at the time of the slavery. Between Jacob moving to Egypt and Moses' birth is only 135 years. Interesting. So, from the time that Jacob moved to Egypt to approximately the time when slavery began, right, you know, give or take like 10 years or so, something like that, we're looking at about 135 years. That's not actually that long, right? I mean, that's like the time of your great-grandparents. Now, let's just think a little bit about what Egypt was like. And not just that, but God gives this promise all the way back in Genesis 15 saying you're going to go to Egypt, right? And you're going to end up being there for like 215 years, something like that in total. And why did he choose Egypt? Have you ever thought about that? Any thoughts on why God chose Egypt? Why Egypt and not just say like, I'm going to put you, you know, in this little oasis in Canaan where nobody will ever find you or something like that? Why does he do that? Right, you got to ask these questions when you're reading through things. God gives the details. He does things for a reason. So I think we can kind of put it together. So he says specifically here, the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet full. So that's one reason, right? He doesn't yet want to drive the Amorites out of Canaan. But it seems like there's a little more going on. God, I think, specifically brought the children of Israel into Egypt because he wanted them to stay separate. Think about this, right? They're to get away from the Amorites, who are going to become increasingly wicked, as we just read. And then on top of that, Egypt specifically because it was physical separation. Where did they end up going in Egypt? They go to Goshen, right? And look at what we're told about Goshen. Check this out. Genesis 46, 28 to 29. It says, he sent Judah before him unto Joseph to direct his face unto Goshen. They came into the land of Goshen. Joseph made ready his chariot, went up to meet Israel his father to Goshen, presented himself unto him, and he fell on his neck, wept on his neck a good while. So it's clearly the separate area where Joseph, being in Egypt, has to get on his chariot, drive all the way to Goshen. I guess you drive a chariot. I don't know what you do. But, you know, you tell your horse to go, whatever it is. So it's a physically separate area from Goshen, right? And you get that when the plagues happen, because Goshen is constantly cut off in the plagues. And so much so that, like, there's no flies there and there's flies all over the land of Egypt. Or there's no darkness in Goshen. There's light and yet there's darkness in Egypt. So God could actually cut off Goshen. So it is this physically separate place. So he brings them to a place where they will be completely separate from the native people, right? I'm going to preserve them. Now, on top of that, how do you think the Egyptians felt about the Israelites? Were they like, sweet Israelites, let's all like get together and hang out. We're going to be buddies. They actually thought, and I just think that this is phenomenal to see how God works here. The Israelites were shepherds, and shepherds were an abomination to the Egyptians, so much so that they wouldn't even eat with them, right? So you find that out in Genesis 46, 31 to 34. Shepherds were so gross to Egyptians that they're like, oh, you know, you smell bad, right? I don't even want to eat with you, kind of thing. So God actually brings his people into a land where, number one, they're physically separate, so they're not actually near anybody else, so that they can be a separate people, the children of the promise, and then he puts them in a place where the local population will look at them and be like, whoa, Israelites, bleh, right? And like, go somewhere else. I don't want to have anything to do with those people. So this is God preserving his children. Nevertheless, you'll recall from our workbook that unfortunately, the children of Israel, as we so often do, manage to avoid the separation. Joshua 24:14, just read this carefully, about what the children of Israel were doing in Egypt. Joshua 21:14 says, "Now therefore fear the Lord and serve him in sincerity and truth. Put away the gods which your fathers served on the other side of the flood and in Egypt." So we actually see that though God put together this separation of making it so that his people would not connect with the Egyptians, would not be together with them, they begin to worship the Egyptian gods in Egypt. Joshua 24:14. And so Israel easily goes back to idols at Sinai, right? They go to and they make the golden calf. It was an easy thing to do because that's what they've been doing for so long. So the Hebrews began to acculturate anyway. Ezekiel chapter 20 tells us the same thing. We have this idea right here. Defile not yourselves with the idols of Egypt, it says. But they did not forsake the idols of Egypt. And so God's response at the end of verse 8 there, I will pour out my fury upon them in the midst of the land of Egypt. So have you ever wondered why it was that some of the plagues ended up going on the Israelites? Well, there you go, right? The Exodus record doesn't tell us, but in fact, what we see when we go to Ezekiel is that they were worshiping the idols of Egypt, and so God tells them to stop, they don't, and so he pours his wrath upon them in the midst of the land, the plagues. So we don't know how long they worshiped them, but we know that God hated it. He talks about that in Ezekiel 23, how he abhorred when they worshiped these Egyptian idols, and thus the plagues come upon them. So, let's try and think about the big picture. So we're looking at the Israelites coming down into Egypt. What was the reason that God brought them into Egypt? To keep them separate. That's the point. So he attempted to keep them separate. Now, what I want us to see is that this is constantly what God is trying to do with the Israelites, right? This is something, it's crazy to just go through this, but constantly, he has to make them a separate people. Constantly, they're going back to the nations of the world. They're worshiping their gods. They're finding ways to be like them. And he has to do things to make them separate. So, for example, in Persia, right, you have the decree of Cyrus there in Ezra chapter 1, verse 2 and 4. The decree of Cyrus that all of the Jews should do what? Return and build the... All right, yes, good. Return and build the temple. You got it. So they're to return and build the temple. The problem is that almost nobody does. When you actually read through the list in Ezra chapter 2, verses 64 and 65, it's like 40,000 people return, right? There were millions of Jews. And this little piddly number are like, oh boy, we can rebuild the temple. And everybody else is just hanging out at home because they think, oh, well, you know, Persia's actually kind of nice. I don't really want to go back to Jerusalem. You know, Jerusalem fell apart 70 years ago. Like, I have a house. I have camels. Maybe they had camels. Anyway, So, you know, that kind of thing, right? And they don't want to leave. So you have this issue of, here are the Jews again, just like they did in Egypt. They are assimilating. They are coming into Persia, and they're not separate anymore. So what does God do? What is the next thing that happens? The story of Esther. And so you will recognize then that the Jews, come Esther, had no choice of whether or not they were Jews. It just suddenly becomes, well, guess what? Now, in the month of Adar, regardless of if you want to be a Jew or not, you're going to die. And so this is what God does. He creates this persecution so that the Jews can't become Persians any longer. They are going to be forced to become Jews. So the persecution prevents integration. And even more, it brings the Jews together. In Esther chapter 8, verses 10 to 12, the Jews then band against their enemies and they fight against them. So the Jews, who used to say, oh, I'm a Persian, yeah, right? Like, they were all excited about being Persians, and I'm going to hang out and live in Persia, forget Jerusalem. It's, you know, it's out in the boondocks, or whatever you'd say. Right? I don't want to go out there. Like, that's how they would feel about that kind of thing. They have their nice life in Persia, and so God brings persecution to make them, to force them to be Jews again. So this is what we constantly see throughout the Bible and throughout history. So now we're going to jump up to modern times, right? The Catholic Church did all kinds of things to make the Jews separate. They're the ones who invented the ghetto. They are the ones who have, there were all kinds of laws about Jews can't marry Catholics and all kinds of things like that. So there were a lot of deals along those lines. But what I want to focus on is more modern history. Let's talk about World War I. In World War I, I think that this is fascinating. Just to see, this is constantly what's going on with the Jews. They had begun to see themselves as Europeans rather than Jews. So take a look at this. This is by Martin Gilbert, right? So world-renowned historian, so this is a good source here. This is what he says about World War I. In the war which came to Europe in August 1914, Jews served in every army and on opposite sides of the trenches and the wire. German Jews fought and died as German patriots shooting at British Jews who served and fell as British patriots, right? This is why we're conscientious objectors, because that's ridiculous. Man for man, the Jewish and non-Jewish war casualties were in an almost exact ratio of the respective populations. Jews and non-Jews alike fought as Germans for duty and for the fatherland. So you actually had, in World War I, Jews shooting each other because they'd said, well, I'm not, you know, first and foremost, I'm a German. Or first and foremost, I'm British. And so they were shooting and killing each other. And this was not what God could allow, because they had to stay separate. They had to be a separate people. Now, I just have a quick video clip. It's of a man named Frank Grunwald. He's a Holocaust survivor, and he's going to tell you about his life in the early 1930s. In the early 1930s, about what it was like being a Jew at the time. And this is something that blew me away when I first heard these guys say this kind of thing, but I want you to hear it from his mouth. And time after time after time, if you read any kind of Holocaust memoirs, you will read the same kind of thing. Ready? Here we go. Here's what he says.
I had this really achy feeling in my stomach before I
was... He's talking about going to school.
In elementary school, very often you were asked what your belief was. I went to my parents and I said, you know, they're asking us what your religion was. What do I say? So when it came my turn in a class to say what my religious status was, I would say without a specific affiliation, basically none. It doesn't necessarily mean I don't believe in God. It just means I do not have a specific religious affiliation. My father, pretty much strayed away from religion.
His father was a doctor.
If somebody would have asked me, who are you, when I was 5 or 6 years old, where did you come from, who are you, I would probably look at them and say, you know, I'm Jeff. I would never say to them, I'm Jewish. I was Jeff.
So this is something, this is not a unique clip. Almost every memoir, all the documentaries that you have interviewing survivors, this is what they'll say, right? He's from Czechoslovakia, so in his mind, he was Czech, right? He says, I wouldn't have told anybody I was Jewish. Why would I say that, right? Because I'm Czech. You know, I was just like everybody else. And so this is assimilation. This is what's happening. And the next thing that happens after the 1930s is the Holocaust begins, 1938. So you can see that this is just constantly the story of the Jewish people. They go to one place, they start to assimilate, God creates persecution, makes it stop. They go to another place, start to assimilate, God brings persecution, makes it stop. You cannot have any choice about whether or not you're a Jew. You are, right? No matter if you want to be or not. And so this is what he does. This is how God preserves his people. And so what I want us to see then is that even though God took the children of Israel to Egypt, he brought them specifically on purpose to a place where they would be physically separate and in which the inhabitants of the land would look at them and think they were gross, right? They continued to assimilate and they began to worship their gods. And so what God does is he then says, okay, well, this is what's going to happen. Come over to Psalm 105. Psalm 105, starting at verse 23. Consider what it says about God's influence on the Egyptians. Psalm 105, starting at verse 23, God's influence on the Egyptians. Here it is, 23. Israel also came into Egypt, and Jacob sojourned in the land of Ham. He increased his people greatly. He made them stronger than their enemies. He turned their heart to hate his people and to deal subtly with his servants. Isn't that amazing? Psalm 105 actually tells us that God caused the Egyptians to hate the Israelites. So he actually purposely, right, this assimilation is happening, and so God, you know, flips the switch. So that not only are they like, ooh, those Israelites are kind of gross, they look at the Israelites and they say, that person is an Israelite, I hate them. Right? And so God, he turns their hearts to hate his people and to deal subtly with them because God will not allow assimilation. Now, there's a powerful lesson to consider in our own lives then. And I'll let you just kind of mull over that. God will not tolerate assimilation. And so if we don't stay separate, he'll make us separate. Because what's interesting is, you remember how long it was from the time of Jacob coming to Egypt to the time of Moses' birth? It was 135 years. Do you know why that's an interesting number? Our community has existed for just a few years more than that. We have existed as Christadelphians for only about 160 years. A lot can change in a few years, from the time that Jacob goes down to the time when Israel is delivered after worshiping idols for years and years. They allowed assimilation to take place. Assimilation happened, and so therefore, God had to make them separate. Just consider that. Now, just to bring this all together, to finish this up, I think when we read Scripture, we have to constantly ask ourselves, how would the people dealing with this event, how would the people experiencing this have felt and what would they have thought about it? Have you ever asked yourself, how would Abraham have felt when he was given this prophecy? When he was given Genesis 15, right? I mean, he would have been in awe that here is God making this covenant with him and that God makes this unbreakable covenant, right? He would have been in awe of that. But at the same time, he's sitting there thinking, wait a minute, you just told me I'm going to go to my death at a good old age, and my children are going to be afflicted for 400 years? That's not the kind of prophecy where you're like, yes, that's awesome, right? Like, that's bad. Afflicted for 400 years and then brought back into the land. You just say that's bad. That's funny. That's right. It's bad. So how would Abraham have felt, you know, trying to process this and trying to put this together? And I think that what really comes out of this is that this was a prophecy that was to be a blessing to Abraham. This was the covenant. And so that even though he had to go through these things and try and process them and put them together, God knew Israel's failings. God knew that even though he attempted to make Israel separate, that they would fail and that they would start worshiping false gods, that they would try and assimilate with Egypt. And so because of that, he would have to have them afflicted in order to stay separate. At the time, Abraham couldn't understand why this would have to happen. But it was God's plan, because God knew how Israel would fail, and he knew what was best. And so I think altogether, what we see coming out of this is a recognition then that even though sometimes we don't understand, even though sometimes we're left sitting there thinking, how does this further God's glory in any way at all? Why is this suffering happening? Why is everything I thought that was going to happen falling apart? We have to learn the same lesson then that Abraham had to wrestle with here. And that is that true humility admits and acknowledges that God's way is higher than ours. Thank you very much. Until tomorrow.